Thanks for joining us for this Views and Brews podcast, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. I'm Rebecca McEnroy. On this very special show, we host the KUT podcast, This Is Just to Say, with Texas Poet Laureate Carrie Fountain, for a tribute to the late poet Tony Hoagland. Enjoy the show. Hello, Miss Fountain.
Hi.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Cactus Cafe. Ah, it's so nice to be here inside air conditioning because it is not okay outside right now. I'm Rebecca McEnroy with KUT, and tonight we are here to celebrate the life and work and book of Tony Hoagland. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce my co-host this evening. We are taping this for a This Is Just to Say podcast. The one and only Texas Poet Laureate and novelist, Carrie Fountain. Welcome.
Thank you, Rebecca. It is a pleasure to be here. Thank you for coming. I thought that we might start by going down the line of incredible panelists we have put together and maybe just getting a sense of who each of us are and how we came to know the work of Tony Hoagland, the poet, since that sound good to you?
I would like to know, too, to start off with, how do you know Tony
Hoagland? Oh, right,
Hoagland? Yeah. You know, what did he mean to you in your life?
Well, I had a very special relationship with Tony because he was my first poetry teacher. We were just joking about, like, that we went to state schools. Like, when you don't know something, you just go, I went to a state school. Because Rebecca's always dropping these, like, philosophers' names into conversations.
I went to a community college.
Oh,
so, I mean, if you really want to get down to it.
Oh, yeah. I studied at New Mexico State University in my hometown of Las Cruces, New Mexico, and kind of stumbled into this poetry workshop with Tony, who was at NMSU, sort of kind of right before he became a very well-known poet. It was right before his collection Donkey Gospel was published. And I mean, you know, there's no other way to say it, but other than that, it changed my life. That class changed my life. And I honestly don't know that I would have come to poetry at all if I hadn't been introduced to it by Tony as a teacher. And his book that we're going to be, that we're selling tonight and sort of celebrating, The Art of Voice, really, you know, is in a way kind of all of his thoughts about what makes a great poem in one place. And one of the last conversations I had with Tony over email was he was telling me about this book and how he was finishing it up. This was maybe a couple months before he died. And he said, I guess it's my teaching legacy, in a very offhanded Tony way. And I said to him, yes, but I am also your teaching legacy. And you know, I was talking to the poet Lauren Berry at Poetry at Roundtop, and I said Lauren is also your teaching legacy. There are so many of us. I do feel in some way personally beholden to Tony, and very happily tasked with keeping his poetic voice alive. So that's my connection to Tony. I'm going to just go down this incredible list. I had to look everybody up. You guys are all my friends, one of my former students, and I looked you up. So let's see, Richard, this is what I've learned about you today. This is Richard Robichaux. Richard is an actor. One of the things I think we're going to talk about is that a lot of the people on the panel today are theater people, and I think there's something to be said about the way that a lot of theater people are drawn to the poetry of Tony Hoagland. So Richard is the head of the MFA acting program at the University of California at San Diego, which is like an amazing best program in the country. He's also an actor. Do you recognize him now? He was in Boyhood, Ocean's 8, and he is in the forthcoming movie, Where'd You Go, Bernadette, which is coming out in a couple days, right?
Yeah.
So this is, Richard, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you came to the poetry of Tony Hoagland?
Thank you. I'm completely unqualified to be here.
And so that's why I'm so honored to be here, because I'm such a poetry nerd and have been for like decades and decades. And but I'm not the poetry nerd that also secretly writes poetry. I really just read it. That's it. I don't write it. I just read it. And back in the day, there are some poems out there that would be inappropriate for any of us to read. But I discovered Tony Hoagland because my best friend in the whole world, Kayla Kagan, who's a great writer and poet, always sends me books, and we always send books to each other. And she sent me years ago Tony's book, What Narcissism Means to Me. And it was the first time I had read Tony. And I've now probably sent 30 copies of that book to different people because it's such a great title. And it's very easy. Like people go, well, it's called What Narcissism Means to Me. Oh, I'd love to read that. So I go, I'll send it to you. Mm-hmm. And so there was something about Tony's work that was incredibly human. And at the beginning of every poem, I felt like he sort of ran into the room because he'd just learned something. And so many poets that I had read, certainly in school, I always felt like they slowly walked into the room to teach me something and that I would never really know. And yet there was something so human in him that I've read all of his books since then. And I always get them as soon as they come out. And then my wife, Natalie, is as I'm reading it, she then reads it afterwards. But as I'm reading it, I always go, oh my God, you have to read this. You have to read this. Or you have to read this. I'm that kind of reader. Mm-hmm. And he really does that to me. In my classes at UCSD, I read a poem every day to start class. Because as I say, there's always a hymn before the sermon. And it's just a way to begin with heightened language and with something that's inherently truthful. And I read probably 5 Tony Hoagland poems over the year. And so I've introduced lots of other people to Tony. I'm so grateful to be here. Thank you, Carrie.
Yes. Next to Richard is Kara Martinez. And Kara is, Dr. Kara Martinez, recently, not so recently, got her PhD at the University of Minnesota. She's a native Texan, as is Richard, and has now returned to Austin as the national coordinator for Live in America at the Fusebox Festival. And Kara, will you tell us a little bit about how you came to the poetry of Tony Hoagland? And if I got anything wrong in that, you can correct me.
Carrie is correct. I also teach with Kirk in playwriting and directing program. I came to the poetry of Tony Hoagland in Kirk and Carrie's living room. I had been teaching high school for a lot of years and had met Carrie via a play where we were attached by a long braid of hair.
Yes. Very.
Yeah, very theatrical. And you just were like, you gotta get to writing. And you were teaching classes in your living room on like Sunday mornings. And so I did this for a very long time, taking classes from Carrie in her living room and using lots of different poets as models for the work that we were doing. And Tony just stuck with me. And one reason he stuck with me is the very title of the poem, Dickhead, which is really an effective title. But after leaving Austin, I lived in Minnesota for a lot of years, doing my PhD and working in different theater companies. And one of the theater companies I worked at was Penumbra Theater Company, which is the nation's oldest black theater company. And I would taught for about 6 summers in their social justice performance education program. I taught the writing courses. And one of the guides for that work, like if you've ever tried to teach high school kids writing, like, that is not the most fun thing. Because their writing is so saturated in structure, because that's what school teaches you. It teaches you how to test well inside structures. And so what you're trying to do is open up voice and to teach them that their own voice is okay. and that they have something to say. And the closer that they get to their own voice, the closer to they get to their own senses. Toni Morrison would say, of freedom. And man, Dickhead was this incredible tool for working with kids who grew up without a lot of traditional resources and from communities of color. It was a model for them to reach out and begin to explore their own diction, their own use of voice, their own way of being in the world. And we read lots of Tony Hoagland. We read Lucky. We looked at grammar. We spent a lot of time looking at Donkey Gospel. And he just offered a kind of honest and approachable way of being in the world and of using a voice that was authentic and personal.
Thank you, Kara. Maybe we'll circle back around to Dickhead. That's not the first time I've said that today. Our next panelist, I had to look him up on the internet. This is he's a playwright, a novelist, and screenwriter, and he's one of the co-producing artistic directors at the Rude Mechanicals, Austin-based theater company. And also, he is the John D. Murchison Fellow in Fine Arts, as well as the Fellow of Bennett Cerf Regents Professorship in Writing at the University of Texas at Austin, which I literally learned when I looked him up on the internet today, though I have been married to this person for 11 years.
The idea that my wife would Google me is the most romantic thing. Like, probably when we were dating, she Googled me but she's never Googled me since. That's
We didn't have Google when we started dating.
Yeah, or else we would not be married. I also met Tony Hoagland in my living room. One of my... a thing that I say about my wife a lot about Carrie is that when we first started dating, I would wake up in the morning and she would already be awake sitting under this little lamp reading a new book of poetry every day. And she read voraciously and I would ask her, do you like that? And frequently she would say, I don't know, I'm trying to read everything. And I think that sense of having a Catholic taste and a discipline in what you do and read everything.
That's a little C Catholic.
Little C Catholic, yeah. A universal taste and try and eat everything and know a little bit struck me just as a writer, as a discipline. But when she loved things like Richard, she would say, read this and share it with me. And once she shared Tony with me, I think there was a sense as a writer that Tony taught me a lot about bravery, I think, and about foolishness. As I was thinking about what I learned from Tony, and later I got to meet him and hang out with him because he liked Carrie. So I got to spend a little bit of time with him at dinners. But there's a kind of sense in which the part of my ignorance is because I want a certain kind of status. And I think that fools have a kind of wisdom because they don't desire that status. And so they'll say anything. The basic principle of the Emperor's New Clothes, that Tony is willing in his poetry to not only look at the world, but I think in the most terrifying way, to look at himself and to say, to lay bare what he sees there. And I think that's a kind of bravery that I aspire to, that I learned through Tony.
Thank you, Kirk. And then finally, I'm so pleased that August Huerta is here with us. August received their MFA here as a fellow at the New Writers Project, which is a wonderful MFA program at UT, and was also one of my students at St. Edward's when I was a teacher at St. Edward's. I'm now the writer in residence there. And I've known them for a very long time, and they're a wonderful poet. And I feel like I kind of threw them in here, and also threw Tony's poetry at them as well. So maybe you could speak a little bit about what you think about Tony.
Sure. Well, actually, I just remembered something a few days ago, which was the first writing about poetry I ever read was a Tony Hoagland essay that you gave me 7 years ago. And I still have the article, and I still pass it around to my friends when I want to tell them about why I like poetry. And I can't remember the name of the title, but the article was about weighing narrative again.
Yeah, I think it was called like the Vertigo.
Yes,
it's about something in the title is Vertigo. Mm-hmm. If you Google Vertigo Tony Hoagland, you could pull up that essay.
So it's like, how do we marry effusive and exciting language with clear and vulnerable narrative. And I still try to remember that when I write.
And I just want to say again that August is an amazing poet, and I'm so proud of them.
Thank you.
I think, you know, this point of weighing things, you know, and something, Richard, that you said about Tony's work is that it's like he's running into the room as opposed to just wanting to teach you something. And I heard an interview with Tony where he was talking about being at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. He was an undergraduate there, but he was part of the Iowa Writers' Workshop. Maybe you can tell me, Carrie, exactly what he was doing in Iowa, but or not. That's okay. But was he at the Iowa Writers' Workshop?
No, I don't think so.
He was an undergraduate at the University of Iowa.
Maybe at the University of Iowa.
Yeah, studying poetry. And he said that he was, you know, intimidated by and kind of disgusted by the way in which poets were so serious and so, where they wore black head to toe and they had something to teach you and they were, you know, they would not laugh. And a lot of his work is bringing that self back and that laughter back into poetry. And it's an interesting space to be in. But what was, you know, poetry like for him? Maybe you can set the stage a little bit into what was he coming into?
I remember he came as a guest at St. Edward's when I taught there, and he described, I'm not sure if it was in Iowa or where it was, but he described sort of reading through the library, the public library, like reading through the library and just trying to find those voices for himself. So, I mean, I don't know that I could speak to what poetry meant to him, but I know that even back, you know, when I was a 20-year-old in his class, I think that he spoke about poetry and speaks in this book so much about poetry. One of the things he said when we read the poet, the Brazilian poet, Adelia Prado, and I've become so sensitive to this, and I think about it all, I still think about this all the time. And I think that it translates to other areas. It's not just writing poetry. You know, I think somebody was saying, like, I just love these poems because they're so easy to read, you know? Like, I just, like, enter them and exit them, and it's, like, really, I just, like, understand everything that's going on in the poems. And this Adelia Prado is this, like, kind of crazy, metaphysical, but devout Catholic poet who, I mean, her poems are, like, whoa, mind-boggling. She has, like, a special relationship with Jesus where she calls him Jonathan. It's like, really, like, her poetry really is, like, and she's never left her, like, small town in Brazil. She's an amazing poet. And so I might have even been the asshole who said, like, I just love it because it's so easy to read. And he said that's the mark of a master. A master poet is someone who knows so much about poetry that they make it look easy, you know? And they make it look like I think about that all the time when I see like an amazing performance or, you know, read an amazing novel. You know, that feeling that like the poem is so present and the poet is so just brilliant that you have that residual feeling that like, I think I wrote that poem, you know? Somehow that feeling is like, that poem actually, I am that. Yeah, I'm the like devout Catholic housewife in Brazil, you know. So that has really shaped the way that I have, I think, approached my life as an artist as well, you know. So that's just a little bit of something that I learned from Tony all those years ago. But I think he celebrated, you know, diction that was high and low, and the juxtaposition of those two things. I think maybe we should have a poem so that we can hear a little bit of Tony's work in the room.
Are you going to read Dickhead?
Should we start with Dickhead?
We can start with Dickhead.
I think that's a great introduction.
I was wondering what everybody's going to read. It's like, I was like, I want to read Dickhead, but you read Dickhead.
Oh, I want to read Dickhead.
Do you want to read
How many Dickhead? Times can we say the word Dickhead?
One. I have a different one.
Okay, you have a different one? Look how I marked it. Dickhead. To whomever taught me the word dickhead, I owe a debt of thanks. It gave me a way of being in the world of men when I most needed one, when I was pale and scrawny, naked, goose-fleshed as a plucked chicken in a supermarket cooler, a poor forked thing stranded in the savage universe of puberty, where wild jockstraps flew across the steamy skies of locker rooms, and everybody fell down laughing at jokes I didn't understand. But dickhead was a word as dumb and democratic as a hammer, an object you could pick up in your hand and swing. Saying dickhead this and dickhead that, a song that meant the world was yours enough at least to bang on like a garbage can, and knowing it and having that beautiful ugliness always cocked and loaded in my mind protected me and calmed me like a psalm. Now I have myself become a beautiful ugliness, and my weakness is a fact so well established that it makes me calm. And I am calm enough to be grateful for the lives I never have to live again. But I remember all the bad old days back to in the world of men when everything was serious, mysterious, scary, hairier, and bigger than I was. I recall when flesh was what I hated, feared, and was excluded from. Hardly knowing what I did or what would come of it, I made a word my friend.
Thank you so much for reading that and reading it so wonderfully, Kara.
I was thinking through all of this, there's so much in Tony that that the mixture of diction, both high and low, and of seriousness and humor, and there's the way I think of it is in terms of playfulness. You've never seen anything so serious as a six-year-old boy play Legos, which I see a lot in my house, or my nine-year-old daughter play LOL dolls. That there's both a when you're playing, I think there's both this sense that like anything can happen and you're free, but you're also, the world disappears and you're absorbed in what you're doing, and you can also be intensely serious. I think Plato said that play is the highest thing that we do, the highest expression of our humanity. And I think Tony does that so well with, he's playing with language, which doesn't mean that it's all jokes and games, but it also means that he's able to go to these places of deep humanity.
Right, or the theorization is in the joke in the game, right? Like we would study this poem as a classroom and we would end up talking about like performances of gender and toxic masculinity. And could we say the word dickhead? Was it, is it a word that could belong to folks who identified as women? Could this poem belong to them? And I mean, we're reading a poem called Dickhead and we get into a pretty serious conversation about how we shape ourselves, how we perform our own gender in the world. But via jock straps flying across a dressing room.
His poetry is so interesting too. I was just listening to a conversation with Adam Phillips, who is a philosopher and psychologist in London, and he has a new book out called Attention Seeking. And in the book, he talks about the ways in which when we try to seek attention, and he talks about attention seeking as like this gift, this miraculous gift that we all have, that is a really wonderful thing that we tend to shame in children and shame in people. Like, oh, you're just trying to get attention, you know? But he talks about it as a very good thing. And he also said that our style is created out of the shame that we experience when we are trying to seek attention and we're shamed for it. And I think this poem like Dickhead and a lot of other poems in his life, like they are shaped in a way of him coming to terms with seeking attention as a man and feeling shame for that in a world as well, you know?
And ambition. I mean, he's so honest about his ambition in so many poems, and in the Art of Voice, he talks about introducing secondary voices in the poem, and he does that so often where someone calls him on it in so many of his poems and so many of his books, of like, you know, like the poem Patience, like you should never get so successful that you can't see your own fat feet, and yeah. It's such a relief to hear someone say, I'm ambitious and I'm still functioning. And then later in his poems, he has a sense of authority about I won't be a great success, and it's okay, and it's unbelievable honesty. So rarely we really admit ambition.
And that sense of culpability in all of his poems, mm-hmm. like it does circle. You know, that poem does circle around to, I am a fallible human, mm-hmm. and we are. You know, I am one voice seeking out. And you know, I think that's a real mark of Tony's poetry and the poetry that has been influenced by his work. This idea that, you know, there's a version of that poem, I think, where it is told from a distance, and it becomes sort of this didactic thing about masculinity, a criticism about masculinity. But the poem goes back to, you know, I wasn't a victim of this thing, you know. I perpetrate and I continue, and you know, I think that's a mark of Tony's work.
Do you have a copy of his poem America? That poem about listening to his students talk about America. Do you know the poem I'm talking about?
Yeah, that's in What Narcissism Means to Me.
Is it up here? I would read that, because that's a poem where he like turns back. I don't know that we have it up here. No.
Oh, you have it. Oh, no, you don't have it. No, we don't have that book. That is
too
like
bad.
His.
Good night, everybody.
Oh, look at. She bought a copy.
Oh, can we borrow that? Hi, thank you. What's your name?
Erica.
Thanks, Erica. You're awesome. I was just compelled, like, it just came up in my Tony Hoagland mental library in terms of him starting with something that seems like a critique and ends up self-reflexive. Like, this to me is marks that sense of bravery where he always comes back to himself. How long is it? Oh, shit. Let me see if I can find a good part. No. Here, I'll read it super fast with no pauses. Yeah, no commas.
That'll be pleasurable.
Good poetry is read, yeah. Just super fast.
But I think the thing that, especially as many of us are professors and some of us have hung out with professors, the sense when you look out at your students and you have those moments where you're like, "What? Who the fuck are these people? And then I think the brave thing that Tony does is turn it back on himself. So this is called America. I think it's about America. Then one of the students with blue hair and a tongue stud says that America is for him a maximum security prison, whose walls are made of Radio Shacks and Burger Kings and MTV episodes, where you can't tell the show from the commercials. And as I consider how to express how full of shit I think he is, he says that even when he's driving to the mall in his Isuzu Trooper with a gang of his friends letting rap music pour over them like a boiling jacuzzi full of ball-peen hammers, even then, he feels buried alive, captured and suffocated in the folds of the thick satin quilt of America. And I wonder if this is a legitimate category of pain, or whether he is just spin doctoring a better grade. And then I remember that when I stabbed my father in the dream last night, it was not blood but money that gushed out of him. Bright green $100 bills spilling from his wounds, and this is the weird part, he gasped, "Thank God those Ben Franklins were clogging up my heart, and so I perish happily, freed from that which kept me from my liberty." Which is when I knew it was a dream, since my dad would never speak in rhymed couplets. And I look at the student with his acne and cell phone and phony ghetto clothes, and I think, I am asleep in America too, and I don't know how to wake myself either. And I remember what Mark said near the end of his life. Quote, "I was listening to the cries of the past when I should have been listening to the cries of the future. But how could he have imagined 100 channels of 24-hour cable, or what kind of nightmare it might be when each day you watch rivers of bright merchandise run past you and you are floating in your pleasure boat upon this river, even while others are drowning underneath you, and you see their faces twisting in the surface of the waters, and yet it seems to be your own hand which turns the volume higher." I almost didn't make it, guys. Whoa! I mean, it's interesting to imagine him, especially reading this book and looking at the way he composed poetry, working on that poem and making that turn where he steers back into himself and says, hold up there, Mr. Hoagland, let's take a look at who's writing this thing.
It's a conceit that he does very well, I think. It's sort of like, oh, this guy's full of shit. And then the moment where he turns and looks at himself, you know. And I think, you know, this is one of the things that's so delightful about this book is that not only the Art of Voice, which is the book that was published posthumously, which is his book on craft and has exercises in the back as well. Great book for teachers of writing and aspiring writers as well. That, you know, sort of, he creates this curmudgeonly voice that is funny and invitingly curmudgeonly, but then that only makes that sharp turn into the real self and the culpability of the self in like that poem so much more wrenching, you know, and effective, I think.
And naturally theatrical. Because it's a scene. He's really written a two-person scene in an with a really graphic environment. And all, I mean, he does that so often. And he talks about this in the book about using extra voices in the poems. I mean, over and over again, he's really good at taking that on. He does that so well.
He was really fascinated with playwriting. We were always trying to get him to come to the Fusebox Festival, and there was always something that, you know, prevented him from coming up. But he really was fascinated, and I think when he met Kirk and learned that he was a playwright, it was like, you could see that he was just very interested in that discipline.
But there was this, I remember one dinner where there was this fascinating sense where he was like, we were trying to talk about, you know, what plays you should see or whatever, but he was basically like, but I got to start over at the beginning and read the ancient Chinese and then the Greeks. And then like this sense of like, well, first I have to read everything that ever existed.
And then I'll come to the Fusebox Festival.
You know, it's so fascinating to me how you read this poem, America, because I think in a lot of ways he was having a dialogue with what it meant to be American, what it meant to be in this world, in this country at this time. And ultimately, I think it really did get him into a lot of trouble, you know, not in a lot of trouble that he shied away from in any way, but it was a very difficult position that he was in when he was calling this out, you know, and calling out America through the voice of the poet. And I'm interested, August, in how you as a student of his were understanding his work at this time in relationship to America and what it meant for him to write as a white man in this country, what he was writing.
I think the two strongest pieces in that poem Kirk just read were like on one side of a scale. One is that he implicates himself. That's important. I don't think he could get away with that poem if he didn't. But the other one is, and I can't remember the line, but he basically says, I'm hurting too. And I think that's what hinges me to that poem. But something I was thinking about when I was reading this book is, it's written by a white man, but there's actually like a gift to be had for myself as a trans biracial person. What he teaches me to do in this book is find language that lets you be multiplicitous. It's not just about the markers of what you look like or how people see you in the world. For example, in that poem, he signposts things about America, like money. And for young trans writers, I think there's an instinct to find things for people to recognize what you're saying, like a body within a body. But this book, I think, is about how do we make a poem with thousands of voices in it at once. And that's a real gift. And I can't regurgitate everything that's in this book, but I feel that I've inherited something.
There's a quote at one point where he talks about how most people think of poetry as a car that only has one seat in it with only one driver, but that in fact, and he's speaking to the craft person, not to the reader, but that in fact there are all these drivers inside us, that I have the voice of my father and of my wife and of my children and of Bill Gates and of Toni Morrison. All these voices have sing through me and talked to me, and letting all those voices speak to each other and argue is such a wonderful thing. I made a little quote from one of his other poems I'm compelled to read a little bit, where he talks about how language, that instead of us learning vocabulary, that vocabulary learns us and it takes control of us. And is a beautiful poem of his called Hearings. He says, when you say a word, you enter its vocabulary. It's got your home address, your phone number, and wait. It won't forget the way that parents who finally bring themselves to say lesbian enter through that checkpoint the country where their daughter lives. And in rereading his poetry, I was really compelled by that idea that our language, that we enter our language's vocabulary rather than our language being something that we speak or we control.
That's a really interesting and difficult space, I think, to be in as a poet, to know that you are at once talking about so many things when you're talking about anything, and that your work is going to be received in a way that you can't control, and that sometimes you're not even aware of and that you're completely out of touch with.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think that, I mean, you sort of hinted at it before, and I think that is one of the things that perhaps made Toni a real divisive figure, especially, you know, Toni died pretty young. He was only 64 years old. So it might be, you know, it's not worth maybe thinking about how, you know, how things might have changed if his life had gone on. But I do think that I think that Toni was a much better poet than he was anything else, you know? And so I think that where those flourishes in his poems, where he does sort of say things that are shocking and edgy, when they then took, once they took on a sort of different life in public discourse, I think when he went to went to address it, I don't know that he was as successful in addressing it as he was in the poem itself. You know, I was thinking when you were reading that poem about him saying that he was really, all he could do well was make similes. Like, that's all he does. That's all he could do well. You know, he was very self-deprecating. And he said that on one occasion. And then I remember him talking about Sharon Olds and about how she's so wonderful at metaphor and image. And he said she relies on it so heavily. And then he made this great simile. He said Sharon Olds is like, it's like one of those weird fish where like one of their little flippers is tiny and they're like, they've got this overdeveloped flipper, you know? I always think about that. I love that image so much. But, you know, I think that, so yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if that.
But we are, we're kind of talking around a poem
yeah.
that maybe one of you would like to read, which is the poem about with Serena Williams, with the reference to Serena Williams in it, which is in What Narcissism Means to Me.
It's also a pretty long poem.
Yeah, it's pretty long, but I think we should read it because I think it, you know, in a way, he was friends with, I don't know if all of you know this story, but to set it up, he wrote this book. A friend of his who taught with him at the University of Texas, Claudia Rankine, responded to the poem in a beautiful, very thoughtful, nuanced way. And he responded to her, and this was very public. So you can go to the Poetry Foundation and you can read the letter, the open letter, the response, and then her poem to his response, which is about healthcare, interestingly enough. And you can read that and you see that this really nuanced dialogue is going on, and it was what, in 2004? 2003, 2004?
Yeah, that sounds right.
And you see, if you're thinking about poets as canaries in coal mines. I mean, you can see the, you know, white anger and backlash to the presidency of Barack Obama that Stephen Thrasher writes beautifully about in The Guardian. You can see what's happening today with race in our country, not only a dialogue about the nuances of race, but this very horrific realization of the violence surrounding race in this country, that he, I think, in this poem was trying to speak to.
And I think, too, I have once tried to teach those letters to one another, because I think it's such a beautiful, honest discussion between intellectual giants about race in a way that's really terrifying in the most fantastic way. I know Claudia a little bit. She's a big fan of the theater and has made a theater piece, a wonderful, she's known for being a poet, but she's made a great theater piece as well. And they're both just like stunning intellectuals. And I think Tony at some point says in his response, he says, "I'm racist and I'm sexist and it's the water I drank as I grew up." Like he owns up to his positionality. I was raised this way, I am this way. And the sense of that if we're going to be healed, rather than denying it and running away from it, like saying this is a thing that is ongoing with me and will not be cured by, it will be cured by ongoing work, if it will be cured at all.
And he's also not just speaking about himself. He's saying, you know,
we are all
racists. We all have been socialized in ways that make us racist and misogynistic. And he was trying to go through, you know, we have to go through. We can't just, you know.
But her book, Citizen,
right,
you know, came out is also saying, like his poem, America, and her poem, Citizen, is saying, we're here together.
Yes.
Like, this is us. We are in this country, in this nation, mm-hmm. together at the same time.
Yes. I think, go ahead and read the poem so we have the kind poem. Of context for...
Richard, you haven't read yet? You want to read? August, you haven't read? You want to read?
Okay.
Yeah.
The change. The season turned like a page of a glossy fashion magazine. In the park, the daffodils came up, and in the parking lot, the new car models were on parade. Sometimes I think that nothing really changes. The young girls show the latest crop of tummies, and the new president proves that he's a dummy. But remember the tennis match we watched that year? Right before our eyes, some tough little European blonde pitted against that big black girl from Alabama, corn-rolled hair and Zulu bangs on her arms. Some outrageous name like Vandella Aphrodite. We were just walking past the lounge and got sucked in by the screen above the bar, and pretty soon we started to care about who won, putting ourselves into each whacked return as the volley went back and forth and back like some contest between the old world and new. And you loved her complicated hair, and her to hell with everybody's stare, and I couldn't help wanting the white girl to come out on top. Because she was one of a kind, my tribe, with her pale eyes and thin lips, and because the black girl was so big and so black, so unintimidated, hitting the ball like she was driving the Emancipation Proclamation down Abraham Lincoln's throat, like she wasn't asking anybody's permission. There are moments when history passes you so close you can smell its breath. You can reach your hand out and touch it on its flank. And I don't watch all that much Masterpiece Theater, but I could feel the end of an era there, in front of those bleachers full of people in their Sunday tennis-watching clothes, as the black girl wore down her opponent, then kicked her ass good, then thumped her once more for good measure, and stood up on the red clay court, holding her racket over her head like a guitar. And the little pink judge had to climb up on a box to put the ribbon on her neck, still managing to smile into the camera flash, even though everything was changing, and in fact, everything had changed already. Poof, remember? It was the 20th century, almost gone. We were there, and when we went to put it back where it belonged, it was past us, and we were changed.
And I encourage you all to read all about it. I think that's a poem that hurt Claudia Rankine quite a bit. Felt like teaching with this guy, like, this guy's my buddy and I teach with him and he thinks these things. And then they have, I think, a wonderful and brave exchange about it.
She wrote, one of the things that she wrote about it was, when offense is being taken, offense is heard everywhere, even in the imagination. When I brought my gaze back to the poem, rereading, it occurred to me the poem was outing a certain kind of white thought. I already knew the nice white lady and her husband, who always held the door open for me, thank you, might be thinking of me as the so big and so black, big black girl from Alabama. But I wanted my colleague to tell them right there in his poem that that kind of thinking, well, it's just not right. But his point, it seemed, was this was whiteness thinking. Surely not all of whiteness. And the black girl, as unintimidated as she was simply a sign of the end of the 20th century. Lord, the times they are a-changin'. And for this brand of whiteness, that is where that thinking stopped. And so I think, you know, in reading those and rereading those and listening, she's pleading for a type of kindness and sympathy and reckoning. And he, using the poetic voice and saying, this is, I'm trying to tell you what America is right now. I'm not going to give you that. And that was a really difficult thing to come to terms with.
And I think that the exchange is compelling. I've read it. But I don't think it was a conversation in the way that a conversation happens. It was very public. And it was through these sort of open letters that were then read at this big creative writing conference. And I just don't know that, you know, this is one of the frustrating things about Tony, is that he is a divisive poet that I think maybe in this day and age, now I'm going to sound like some curmudgeon, it's like you either cancel him or you have to be an apologist for him. And the way that he responded to Claudia Rankine and the poem itself, which I'm sorry, I don't think it's a very good poem. I don't think that's one of Tony's best poems. And I don't think his response was great. And it was very male to me and would not back down. And so I think that's frustrating to me as someone who, I mean, I feel very, I feel feelings that are very sort of familial toward Tony. And I love his poetry. And I loved him as a person. So it's frustrating to me to sort of be in, I find myself all the time in these sort of like moments where like, oh, that's right, you wrote an open letter because you hate Tony Hoagland and it was published. And, you know, it's like this weird position to be in. And so I think it was an interesting conversation, and I think it was important, especially for what came next with Claudia Rankine. You know, then she went on to publish this book, Citizen, which really, I mean, absolutely was one of the most important books of anything that has been written in the last 10 years, a bare assessment and a conversation about race and racism. But in some ways, I think that the nuance gets lost in a conversation that's held in open letters. And then in the wake of it, you know, then it was just like over, and it was like, Tony Hoagland got canceled, and you know, it's just like there's. I think there's more there, you know. And I think that Tony's intentions in that poem and in the conversation with Claudia are not to say, you know, I refuse to stand up to, you know, to be. To the, you know, the couple that opens the door, the part that, and I don't think that his intention is to deny that, but I think that his position in that argument was weakened by his stubbornness and his sort of personality, and that's what I mean when I say I think that he's a much better poet than he is anything else. You know,
Richard.
Well, you know, as an acting teacher, I'm always talking about. What I call expensive acting, which means acting that costs something, and not not acting you can get on any street corner. But you go, no, it's going to have to cost something. And on my door of my office, just like a professor, I have little quotes. And this is one of Tony's. And I think there is something about the kinds of poems he writes cost him. Mm-hmm. It really did cost him. And some of them he deserved to pay the cost. And there was a certain amount of bravery that he says, I'm going to cost. And so I'm going to read you this, that I read this to the actors all the time. Now, this is from his book, Sophistication, which is another book on poetry. It's a great, great book of essays. Of course, as everyone knows, in writing, it is important to keep leaning on a poem until it gives up its last secret, the one drop of whale oil at its core. In this case, that drop is clearly in the last handful of lines. That is what pays the poem's rent, by which I mean the rent of a reader's attention. I used to feel, and I still do, that if the poem hasn't cost the writer something real, if the poem has not broken up a little of the ego crust, has not hurt a little in the making, it is probably not a real poem. This is an arguable contention, of course. There are many kinds of poems. But I like poems on which the blood is wet.
Wow.
I like poems on which the blood is wet.
Yeah, yeah. And amazing. There's so much of that, and that's why the theatrics of him, and him using different voices successfully sometimes and not successfully sometimes, because you confuse and go, is that Tony's voice, or is that his invented voice of America, or of this, or that, and so he may not have been good at translating that all the time.
August, I mean, what do you talk about when you talk about the multiplicity of self within the poem? You know, I mean, that comes across in a lot of his, in almost all of his work. Which poems really speak to you about them?
Do you mean in this book in particular? In
whatever
voices. Well, I did bring one poem, and I had to handwrite it down because my printer at work was broken. But it's in that book. If I could borrow it, yes. It's called Jet. Okay. Sometimes I wish I were still out on the back porch drinking jet fuel with the boys, getting louder and louder as the empty cans drop out of our paws like booster rockets falling back to Earth. And we soar up into the summer stars. Summer. The big sky river rushes overhead, bearing asteroids and mist, bind fish, and old spacesuits with skeletons inside. On Earth, men celebrate their hairiness, and it is good, a way of letting life out of the box, uncapping the bottle to let the effervescence gush through the narrow, usually constricted neck. And now the crickets plug in their appliances in unison, and then the fireflies flash dots and dashes in the grass like punctuation for the labyrinthine, untrue tales of sex someone is telling in the dark, though no one really hears. We gaze into the night as if remembering the bright, unbroken planet we once came from, to which we will never be permitted to return. We are amazed how hurt we are. We would give anything for what we have. I think I was drawn to this poem because this year's the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, so I've been big into rockets. But when you talk about multiplicity, there's an interesting play with masculinity, I think. It reminds me in the beginning of like the Twitter posts of Drill, like the boys. But then at the very end, it's...
Wait, I'm sorry, you have to explain that. The Twitter posts
The poster, Drill, he's a comedian. He posts these kind of oblique... angry, absurd tweets making fun of, you know, voices you might recognize, like Donald Trump. He has this joke of the, he uses this vague character called the boys, which is, I think, meant to represent dudeness. I don't know. I haven't actually sat down and analyzed it yet, but... Well, I think that's going on in here, but masculinity to me kind of unravels at the end when he says, we are amazed at how hurt we are. I feel that, and I still haven't really unraveled what this last line, he says, "We would give anything for what we have." I don't know what to make of it, but that's fun because I've been sort of weighing it in my hands all day. But that's what I thought of when you said multiple voices.
I think that's a real moment in that last line. And I don't think Tony gets spoken enough in this sense, but I think it's very like metaphysical and spiritual and mysterious. I think it's something about that, you know?
And Kara, you taught in Minnesota a social justice program in a black theater organization. Talk about coming to terms with Tony and what he was thinking in that setting, in that space.
Well, I think, you know, when you work with kids who don't necessarily like come from a space of privilege, be it economic, gender, race, all the intersections therein, that rarely is an injustice a surprise to them, right? They're like, no shit. Like this is like Tony Hoagland isn't going to wrench open their world. Like life has already taught them how to navigate complex worlds. I think the practice is how do we have conversations that don't exist in binaries and dualities, which our country is really terrible at. That we like to be on either end of righteousness. And like sitting with students and talking about imperfection, talking about multiplicity, talking about being biracial, and that blackness and whiteness can live in the same body, or Latinaness and whiteness can live in the same body, and that it's messy and complicated, and not about being right or wrong. That's a practice. It's a practice we could all do to practice more. I think the trick is to also then simultaneously acknowledge that the cost of that practice is different for different communities. Like, I don't want to sit and do Tony's work with him in figuring out his masculinity, like, or his ideas on race. I'm like, that's for you to do, Tony. I read your poem, see you later, when it comes to those conversations. But we have to practice. And so a lot of what we were just establishing with those students is when you think about different theories of social justice, that is a thought practice. And that you have to continually engage with it. And I think you even see him, like he's constantly moving in those dualities. Like the poem Lucky, when he's talking about the relationship. Do you got it? Okay. I got it. It's in Donkey Gospel. Between punishment and love and what it means to escort a parent away from life. It's so beautiful and so hard and ugly.
Well, you're finding that poem. I will remember that when Tony was here giving a reading at dinner, I think he said, like, you know, if anybody has a poem that they'd like me to read, and Kirk asked him to read Lucky, and he said, oh no, I won't read that poem anymore. That's my Rocky Mountain High.
I was like, what an asshole to be like, any poem you want me to read? And you're like, yeah, read Lucky. He's like, no.
Right.
By the record. Yeah. You know, and it's funny, too, that you kind of brought up his relationship to his dad. I mean, we're not talking about that at all, but a lot of his poems are about his relationship with his dad. And he said once he killed his dad many times in his poem.
Tony's father was in the military, and they moved around a lot when he was a kid, and his father was
really
in the military.
Intense.
There's sort of a companion poem to this about his father's language as he dies, and his father losing his language as he dies. It's really beautiful.
But let's hear it. Lucky.
Rocky Mountain High,
yeah,
baby.
I stand by John Denver, and I stand by this poem. Lucky. If you are lucky in this life, you will get to help your enemy the way I got to help my mother when she was weakened past the point of saying no. Into the big enamel tub half filled with water, which I had made just right, I lowered the childish skeleton she had become. Her eyelids fluttered as I soaped and rinsed her belly and her chest, the sorry ruin of her flanks and the frayed gray cloud between her legs. Some nights, sitting by her bed, book open in my lap while I listen to the air move thickly in and out of her dark lungs, my mind filled with praise as lush as music. Amazed at the symmetry and luck that would offer me the chance to pay my heavy debt of punishment and love with love and punishment. And once I held her dripping wet in the uncomfortable air between the wheelchair and the tub until she begged me like a child to stop. An act of cruelty which we both understood was the ancient, irresistible rejoicing of power over weakness. If you are lucky in this life, you will get to raise the spoon of pristine frosty ice cream to the trusting creature mouth of your old enemy. Between the taste buds, because the taste buds at least are not broken, because there is a bond between you, and sweet is sweet in any language.
Oh my God. Now, I know we're coming to a place where we're going to have a few questions before we have to wrap up, but what you said before you read that was, I stand by, right? And I think that, you know, I have a question for Kirk and for Richard. You know, when Tony was talking about what the poem The Change was about, he said, this is for white men. And I think that having conversations about race in groups of people where it's mainly white men, and then standing up and saying, listen to what Tony Hoagland is saying, you know, that takes a lot. And also to back him up and to say, his poems are incredible poems, and he has something to teach us outside of this, is a very brave position to be in. And he has a poem called Lawrence, in which he talks about his relationship to D.H. Lawrence. I think maybe you brought with you.
I brought just a quote, but yeah, it's interesting. I failed to stand up for D.H. Lawrence.
And it's in, like, his failure that you realize, you know, there are a lot of things we don't say, a lot of things that inspire us and continue to teach us that we're not necessarily willing to stand up for in public. So before we open it up for questions, like, I'd just like to thank you all for coming out, for talking about the work of Tony Hoagland as well. But
I just really feel like, I mean, we need to hear Richard read one of Tony's poems.
Oh, we do.
Because this is a highly tuned.
He was in Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, for the love of God.
You know what? We've read so many of his early poems, yeah. and so I have a poem that's from his book, Priest Turned Therapist Treats Fear of God, which was when he was sick, and he speaks with an authority. Of somebody who is close to the veil. And we haven't heard this voice of his yet.
Before you read that, talk a little bit about, he got sick.
He was ill for a few years before he died. And he died of pancreatic cancer. And, you know, I think went through some treacherous experimental treatments and things, and was living between Santa Fe and Houston, MD Anderson, and where he taught at the University of Houston. In that time, he published two books of poems. He wrote and published two books of poems and a number of essays.
And he passed in October of 2018.
October, mm-hmm, of last year.
And this is a poem of someone nearing death, and it's not a regret poem. And that's what I think is so powerful. Better Than Expected, I mean, that's the title. Better than expected. Things were not as bad as I had thought. The scrape in the fender of the rented car could be hidden with a little white paint before I returned it to the agency. This CD of New Age music, which I disliked at first, with its synthetic wind of pulsing jellyfish, does a remarkable job of slowing down my heart. Merely to have survived to this point is already the most unlikely triumph. To still be breathing and trying to improve. Things are definitely better than expected. I'm not on trial for anything. I have given up on the idea of great success. The oncologist says the X-ray shows no abnormalities. We are always trying to come to a decision. always in a place where we are making up our minds whether the soup is good, the flowers pretty, whether we are fortunate or poor. All my life, I have been loved by women, held up by water, ignored by war. I have outlasted the voluntary numbness I required in order to remain alive. Why shouldn't I be able now to walk down the street under the overhanging trees and raise my arms and say that the rain shaking down from the leaves is not an inconvenience, but a joy? Love that poem.
I also think we'd be remiss if somebody did. Will you read Barton Springs? Somebody has to read Barton Springs.
I was just thinking that too.
Oh, yes.
I was just thinking that.
I'll read that poem. That wasn't the poem that I was going to read, but thanks, Kirk.
Sorry, buddy. I do think while you look for that, I mean, I think as a white man learning about, I mean, he wrote a lot about whiteness and thinking, I mean, the part of him that I admire and want to continue to learn from is the part that remains self-critical and wanting to look at, own up to, fight. You know, as Kara said, it's the work, it's not work that other people need to do for me or with me, but I think it's work that, you know, in his best moments he engaged with, and I want to be self-critical in the ways that he was. I do think in that exchange with Claudia, the moment in which he talks about his own racism and sexism and America's racism and sexism is, and in a way that like predates a lot of sort of wokeness or consciousness, I think is a moment that I want to learn from. And then this is about Austin.
I don't think that he's in that moment excusing it. Yeah. I think he's saying this is where I start from, you know. Yeah.
Well, I think he's calling it out a lot.
Yes.
You know, he's
yes.
saying, like, I mean, if he were alive today, he would say, the problem is Trump, yes, and Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah.
And, you know, this and this.
Tony, I think he would also say, and Tony Hoagland.
Yeah.
I think that's what he's trying to say there. And Kirk Lynn.
Yeah.
So this poem is called Barton Springs, and it comes from the book Unincorporated Persons in the Late Honda Dynasty. This poem was written before Tony became ill. Barton Springs, one of our, Barton Springs. Oh life, how I loved your cold spring mornings of putting my stuff in the green gym bag and crossing wet grass to the southeast gate to push my crumpled dollar through the slot. When I get my allotted case of cancer, let me swim 10 more times at Barton Springs. In the outdoor pool at 6 a.m. in the cold water with the geezers and the jocks. With my head bald from radiation and my chemotherapeutic weight loss, I will be sleek as a cheetah, and I will not complain about life's pedestrian hypocrisies. I will not consider death a contractual violation. Let my cancer be the slow-growing kind, so I will have all the time I need to backstroke over the rocks and little fishes, looking upwards through my bronze-tinted goggles into the vaults and rafters of the oaks as the crows exchange their morning gossip in the pale mutations of early light. It was worth death to see you through these optic nerves, to feel breeze through the fur on my arms, to be chilled and stirred in your mortal martini. In documents elsewhere, I have already recorded my complaints in some painstaking detail. Now, because all things near water are joyful, there might be time to catch up on praise. So we can open it up to questions, comments, thoughts, arguments.
You know, I did have one comment on hearing the poem America. Y'all were talking about his different voices. And it occurred to me that, am I too long? Okay. It occurred to me when he was using the speech of the guy he called full of shit, is that it was a critique of America that Herbert Marcuse would have made if he could have spoken or written in colloquial American English.
I wouldn't be surprised if he had read Marcuse and then translated it for us so that we could understand it. That was, I think, like Richard, I think as a playwright and a person who's obsessed with the theater, that idea that these multiple voices speak in us all the time and that he wants to, rather than say, oh, I don't want to hear, you know, the voice of my mother, to say, let it speak to me for a while and be at peace with it and make this kind of peace.
I remember him saying in that class that I took with him so many years ago. I should also say that I was a student of Tony's when I was 20 years old, and then I didn't see him or speak to him for a number of years, and then kind of contacted him, and we got to know each other again. And it wasn't until a couple of years later that I said, I got the sense. I said, you know, I was your student when I was like 20 years old. I was in one of your classes at NMSU, and he was just like shocked. He was shocked, and I think he was a little embarrassed that like he had no memory of me or my poems, which were, thank God, he has no memory of my poems back then. Oh, I'm sorry. No, this is what I was going to say. Sorry. That was not just a personal anecdote. He would say in that class, you want to harness and use your obsessions, you know? And that has really been something that I've thought about all my life since then as well. The idea that, like, you know, sometimes I think, it's like what Adam Phillips in that talk was saying, this sort of like that I think we're encouraged to kind of like cure obsessions, you know, to cure them or to see, you know, what will get you over your obsessions. But if you sort of, you know, lean into them, for lack of a better term, they can show you where they want to go, you know. And I think that in those poems and those voices, I think that's some of it, you know, the things that we want to avoid if we go through them.
Who said digression is a form of secular revelation? That's a quote. I can't remember, but we digress. Secular revelation. Another question?
Hello. My name is Ed Epperson, and I'm 80 years old, and I have Parkinson's disease, so I was born before Tony. And two of my favorite people in the world are Tony and Adam Phillips. I came over here without any idea of what we were going to talk about, but I really appreciate what we've said and honor Tony so much.
I was wondering when you were talking about Adam Phillips, I wonder if Tony knew about and had read Adam Phillips. It seems like somebody he would have been fascinated with.
I think so. Well, I don't know, but I mean, it's like, they talk about similar things in similar ways, you know, and paying attention. You know, I think that's one thing about poets and poetry and actually, you know, people in the theater. It's like an artist, they pay attention. They pay attention to the world around them. And sometimes it's too overwhelming. You know, but
yeah, you take, you know, you have to, you know, I'm a person, so I take things personally. That's how persons take things, right? And so I have to talk to actors all the time and go, you know, that's actually your superpower, that though the society around you will say, oh God, you take everything, so this, you can harness that for good in your work. And that's something he does. He has a poem called Personal, and he says, life, I'm, you know, I made a scene. I made a scene.
Mm-hmm. Right, I think also as he got older, in his writing, I mean, long before he was sort of staring down his mortality and continued writing through his illness, I really do think he was more and more drawn to that notion of being awake and alive and perceiving and being here for it, you know? That idea of, like, now we might have time to catch up on praise, you know?
Yeah.
Care?
I was just thinking about what is there a more democratizing process than to take things personally? Mm-hmm. And to let yourself live in your own vernacular, as he talks about in Voice, and to freely move between high and low language, to be vulnerable in the ways that life has taught us to be vulnerable and to fear vulnerability. And if we want to head towards social justice and multiplicity, then folks have to be allowed to encounter that process on their own terms. And I think that's why this is such an amazing text. It's a guide to sort of discovering that for yourself or offering it to your students.
Can I ask a question?
Oh, one second. One moment at the question. Just complete a thought.
Oh, I was August just going to, the thought passed through my head of like, it's possible that Tony Hoagland's the only racist person ever, right? Because Trump assures us that he's not racist. Like, there's a kind of boldness to say, like, to take some responsibility and culpability. If you look at everybody in the world and everybody's like, what's it? There's this really scary quote by Patricia Highsmith that, like, nobody thinks they're a bad person, even murder. Like, there's a rationalization, there's a reason. Nobody believes they're a bad person. And to be able to see yourself as a sinner and to say, yeah, well, there's at least one racist in the world and I know him and he's me, is a kind of scary thing.
And August, you were going to say something?
Oh, right. You reminded me of one of the chapters in this book where he talks about using like what would be ordinary language, everyday language, cheap language, like or I mean, like filler. And I always thought that was sort of cheating. But maybe it is. But what I learned from the book is it's also communal. And that's really valuable.
Yeah. And if you control language to such an extent that that's no longer a possibility, that kind of language is no longer a possibility, then you keep it locked in white elitism. Like, you have to open it up to allow for difference.
Okay, a question?
Does this mic? Oh, there it is. Okay.
It's way on.
Okay. Well, we have a number of writers here, a number of poets, and going back to the poem America, which I'm sure also refers to Ginsberg's poem America. This is a question that I think maybe the writers can address, performers. A poet always has a problem with the personal pronoun I. Readers are always going to assume that the I is the poet. And in the America poem, that's going to happen, and that occasioned, I guess, an exchange of letters. What method can a poet use, or any writer actually, to indicate that the I is not I, besides going to the third person? Does anybody have any suggestions here?
This book is full of suggestions for you. I mean, talking about voice and bringing in other voices. It's funny that you should say that. I was actually just listening to, I searched Tony's name on iTunes podcast and a podcast came up and just, I'm right now, I'm like a comedy sketch, just dropping stuff. And this group of they were really smart, but it wasn't the poem America, but it was the poem that starts out, "When I think of everything I know about America, I think about kissing my best friend's wife in the parking lot of the zoo." And then it goes on to, and it's about, you know, it's about, it's a similar vein. And, you know, and then when they start to discussing it, they say, well, you know, he was really, you know, not afraid to like lay it all out there, you know, and his best friend seems like such a nice guy. I mean, and it was really like they were talking about it, like that's just, you know, I don't know. I think you just have to. I mean, you know, people ask me that about my work all the time, you know, and I don't know that you have a lot of control over that once things are out in the world. I mean, you're a poet, right? Are you a poet?
Yes.
Yeah.
I ponder it.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's this false notion in acting as well, is that all things are biography, mm-hmm. and not observation, and that so that if I'm a writer or if I'm an actor, I'm gonna act, you know, if I do this movie or that, it's like, oh, that's him. Oh, well, that was easy for him though. That's him, mm-hmm. right? That idea of biography, and like if you wrote that novel or you wrote that play, you wrote that poem, whatever you did, well, that must be your real life. You go, no, I have an imagination, mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah.
I think too. There's this. I mean, for each of us, I think a comforting thought in my own meditation and my own practice, trying to be a human being, is like, I am not my thoughts. I have thoughts, but I'm not my thoughts. God forbid if I were my thoughts. And that in this book especially, Tony talks about, rather than trying to push these things away, I don't ever want to think about capitalism or about the voice of desire. I'm going to invite those things in. I'm going to sometimes let my father speak to me and through me. I'm going to let my mother speak to me and through me. Earlier today I was thinking about, Carrie and I recently saw the movie Rocket Man and really loved it, and it's Elton John's biopic, and there's a scene toward the end where Elton John's little 5-year-old self says, "When are you going to hug me?" And there's a way in which I was thinking about Tony in relationship to that, rather than like that's not cured, the 5-year-old doesn't go away, but letting that voice speak and still be alive and still say, I still need to be loved, I still need to be hugged, that attention seeking, and rather than tell that voice, shut up, you should be able to take care of yourself, to let these many voices like speak and live with you, and sometimes you do need that.
And I think in some ways too, to like let that, like rather than the voice that says like, God, you know, I think of myself as someone who's not racist, but you know, to let that voice also speak, and rather than say like, shut up, you shouldn't exist, or you're not, you know, you're not a progressive, and you're not a, you know, this is, you abhor this, and yet, you know, how are the ways that we benefit from institutionalized, you know, systems of power ourselves? You know, I think that that's my sense of what Tony was doing in that poem and in many of his poems.
Thank you. And so thank you, Carrie.
You're
Fountain.
Welcome. Thank you all for
Richard
being.
Robichaud, Cara Martinez, Kirkland, and August Huerta. Thank you so much for coming out and celebrating the life of Tony Hoagland. Have a wonderful evening and come out again. Thank you.